Welcome to a Christmas edition of Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from holidays past. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. In this hour, Dragnet from 1952. And right now, it's an episode of The Bob Hope Show where he goes shopping for Bing Crosby's gift, an NBC episode from December 7th, 1948.
Show with our great singing star, Doris Day.
Well, I swan.
Our special guest, Bing Crosby. The Four Hits and a Miss, the new Les Brown Band.
We use swan exclusively. How about you?
Yes, how about you?
Oh, me? My name is Robert, hair of gold, eyes of blue, and muscles like Errol Flynn Hope.
And now, Bob Hope's Swan's Eye View of the News. Berlin, Germany. The gap in Russian-American relations widened here this week when Germans living in the Soviet zone were forbidden to chew gum because it is too American.
Berlin is now divided into three zones: spearmint, juicy fruit, and stick it behind your ear, Fritz. Here comes the commissar. After the law was passed against gum chewing, they arrested one German because his jaws were moving. Policeman said, "You were either chewing gum, talking, or eating." The man said, "I was only breathing." Policeman said, "Let me see your permit." Gee, imagine if they abolished gum chewing here in America. We'd be in an awful fix. What would hold the theater seats together? I owe a lot of wonderful memories to gum chewing. I used to chew it as a kid, and my girlfriend used to chew it, too. In fact, when we kissed, sometimes it lasted 3 hours.
Washington, D.C. Dr. Northam, a nationally famous biochemist, has proved to the Department of Agriculture that the addition of minerals to the soil produces vegetables that are more than five times as rich in vitamin content.
They've injected so much iron into the celery, lettuce, and radishes that now if you toss a salad and it misses the bowl, it can break your leg. And the latest method is to drop the minerals on the soil from a plane. You have to aim carefully, though. One Pennsylvania farmer missed his field, and a mile away, John L. Lewis came running out of a mine shaft with a geranium popping out of each eyebrow. That'd be better on television, wouldn't it? All those vitamins in the soil are affecting the earthworms, too. I went fishing and put one on a hook, and the first thing I knew, the worm got a stranglehold on a trout, flipped him up in the bank yelling, "Hey, look at me, I'm Gorgeous George."
New York, New York. Generals, politicians, entertainers, and secretaries all hit the literary jackpot as this week found their books topping the bestseller lists.
Everybody's writing a book about their experiences except Artie Shaw. He's still doing research. And Drew Pearson tried writing a mystery story, but it didn't work out. He couldn't control himself. In the first paragraph, he predicted who did it. I'm reading a book right now that's very interesting. It's about a traveler who's hiking around the United States, and when he comes to California, he thinks it's so beautiful that he sleeps at night under a rose bush. It's called The Case of the Quick Frozen Tourist.
Los Angeles, California, one of the largest crowds in football history, this Saturday jammed the Coliseum to see the University of Southern California score the major football upset of the year by holding Notre Dame to a 14-14 tie.
I've never seen such a crowd in the Coliseum. The stands filled at capacity, and some of the fans even more so. There were 100,000 people at the game, including me. People were sitting so close together that when I got up, I was wearing a blanket, three fraternity pins, open-toed gold sandals, and a... There's more, but if you don't want it, okay. Open-toed gold sandals and a raccoon coat with a student still in it. Oh, you're so impetuous. Boy, that was really a rough game. I never saw two teams knock each other around like that. In one play, a Trojan ran 40 yards for a touchdown, but they called him back. The ball he was carrying had ears on it.
Thank you.
cover girl of modern television and radio magazine, Miss Doris Day with Les Brown and his band. Miss Day, please.
My darling, get used to the name of my darling. It's here to stay. Till a moment ago, we were Mr. and Miss, discussing the weather, avoiding each other's eye. Till a moment ago, when we happened to kiss, and we kissed the Mr. and Miss goodbye. Now at last, I can sigh.
My darling.
My darling, I've wanted to call you my darling for many and many days.
My darling.
My darling, I fluttered and flew like a starling. My courage just melted away. Now all at once, kissed me, and there's not a thing I'm saying enough to say, except my darling, get used to the name of my darling, it's here to
That was great, Doris.
Oh, thanks, Hi, but I'm really surprised I was able to sing at all tonight. I'm so knocked out from Christmas shopping.
Oh, yeah, I knew you were helping Bob with his shopping. Tell me, Doris, is Bob spending very much money this Christmas?
Well, he said he was going to take it very easy because he lost a lot of money in the market.
Oh, did he have some of that amalgamated tin just before it went down?
No, he got caught with 52 airmail stamps when they dropped to 4 cents.
Well, that shopping tour, that tour must have been some experience.
Oh, you said it. I was waiting for him in front of Woolworth's. He was 10 minutes late, and I was getting very impatient.
Gee, I better get going or I'll be late, but this is so interesting. I just can't tear myself away. That girl is so beautiful, and she's looking right at me. She smiled at me, and now she's winking. Gee, she's beautiful.
Look, Bud, I don't mind you looking at the television, but keep your clammy nose off my window.
I didn't have my nose against your window.
You did, too. And look at those 2 spots you made with your eyeballs.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Now take your stool and your little bag of popcorn and go home.
All right, mister. Well, I'd better get going.
Ho, ho, ho. Christmas, boy.
Well, thanks. And Yuletide greetings to you, Jolly St. Nick.
Who's Jolly? This California sunshine's freezing me to death. My feet are killing me, and this morning my unemployment check bounced.
Gee, are things really that bad?
Things are nauseating, boy. They're horrible. Merry Christmas, everybody. Put some money in the pot, boy.
Well, wait a second, Santa. Who does this money go to?
Well, it's for a very good cause. It's for the undernourished and downtrodden Eskimos of Upper Glendale.
Now, wait. There aren't any Eskimos in Glendale.
Can you prove it?
No.
Put some money in the pot, boy.
Well, I got to meet somebody right away or I'll be in trouble.
He's got troubles. Boy, I'm married to the most miserable, mean, and ornery woman that was ever allowed out of the snake pit.
She's really bad, huh?
Revolting. Merry Christmas, everybody. Boy, my wife is so homely, she's got a face like a plate of mashed potatoes with a lump still in it. Put something in the pot, boy.
Okay, here's some loose change.
Thanks. You know, I only get 10% of what I take in. Last week, the organization made $20, and all I got was $150.
Well, just a second. If you only get 10%, how come they got $20 and you made $150?
Oh, I don't know. Just lucky, I guess. Merry Christmas!
Oh, I'm sorry I kept you waiting, Doris, but here I am.
Oh, that's all right, Bob, but you better give me your Christmas list so that we can get started now.
I don't know which present to buy first.
Well, you should always buy the first gift for the person you love the best.
But, Doris, I've got everything.
Come on, let's go in this department store right here, huh?
Okay.
Oh, Bob, about the present you're going to buy for me.
Oh, there's a friend of mine over there. Hello, Mort.
Bob, when you buy a gift for someone, don't you agree that you should buy them something they really want?
Oh, naturally.
Good. Well, I want either a real emerald and ruby bracelet and a full-length ermine coat trimmed with mink, or a platinum diamond wristwatch studded with diamonds.
Hello, Mort.
Okay, let's look at your list now. The first name you have is Crosby, and right next to Crosby's name, you've written $2.25. Is that what you're going to spend?
That's plenty. Last year, I wanted a motorcycle to ride around Paramount Studios with, and I hinted it to Crosby. I must have told him 50 times that I wanted a motorcycle, and then came Christmas.
What did he give you?
An oil can and a road map.
Well, look, Bob, I have a wonderful idea. You give me your money because I know much more about shopping than you do, and I can save you an awful lot.
Okay, here's my wallet.
Oh, there's something that would be nice for Bing. A set of match golf clubs.
Oh, wait a second.
Oh, Clark! Clark, how much are those golf clubs?
$190.
Hello, Mort.
Oh, gee, I think they're wonderful.
Doris, wait.
And how much is that bag that goes with them?
That's $200.
It's just what we want.
Doris, wait.
We'll take the bags and the clubs. Let's see, that's $390, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's $400 and keep the change.
Mort, where are you?
Well, Bob, let's get going now because we...
Wait a second, Doris. I want to ask this floor walker something. Pardon me, mister.
Yes, sir. Can I help you?
Hey, look. It's High Everback.
Yeah, get a load of him in a cutaway coat and striped trousers wearing a gardenia.
All floor walkers wear gardenias.
In their hair? Here, ladies and gentlemen, the man who boiled the hot water when Al Jolson was born, Mr. Bing Crosby, right there.
A little bird told me that you love me.
That you love me.
And I believe that you do. That little bird also told me I was falling.
You're falling.
Falling for no one but you. There's no use denying I might as well confess. Of all the girls I know, dear, I'm sure I love you best. A little bird told me we'll be happy.
Gonna be happy.
And we believe that it's true. Love that little love bird.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, and good night, everybody.
Good night. Wait a minute, boy. Where are you going?
I sang my number. I gave the show a little class. Now I'm off.
Gave the show a little class. Look, you hopped up Hildegard. You'd better stop going to that African barber. He's been shrinking your head again.
Flattery will get you nowhere, Saggy. Now, come. Where's this new show of yours everybody's been talking about?
Well, haven't you heard? I'm on for Swan this year. They make soap, you know.
Yeah? It's too bad it's not something you use.
Hey, Lump Lap, you've got two chins. Would you like to try for one?
Now, let's face it, Nostril King. Before I sang my song, this show was laying a large swan egg. True or false?
Get him. Look, Philco Knob, last week...
A large set.
You're wearing the cabinet there, too. Look, last week my hand slipped and I happened to tune in your show. Now I know why it's transcribed and you broadcast it later.
What do you mean?
Gives you time to get out of town and hide before the people hear it.
To think, when I first met this boy, he had a job blowing out glove compartments at a car wash.
Steady, couch pouch.
Now look, ratchet head, if I'm to...
Wait, late writing. Oh, there's some sneaky things going on.
If I'm going to endure this vilification, I want my money first.
Shall I explain vilification before we go on? He'll understand it around Gonzaga anyway. How about that? He's been on the show for 3 minutes and he's worried about the loot. Bing, what are you knocking yourself out for? After all, you know you can't take it with you.
I know, so I'm sending my brother Everett on ahead to open up a charge account for me. I'm ready.
Bing, there's something that's always bothered me. When you send in your income tax, how do you get that mattress in the mailbox?
Easy, bog brain. I never have any trouble with my taxes. Why, I'd give President Truman the shirt off my back.
I know. I saw pictures of him wearing it in Key West.
What's that you're wearing there? Tamale husk with a belt in the back?
Nice of you to slip your coat on for this, anyway.
Think I'm too frisky?
Say, Don't care for that, huh? I guess not. We'll ignore the next six lines. All right. New kind of radio. Just throw the whole thing away. Hey, look. You better stop being so frisky or I'll tell Abby Rentz to stop souping up your wheelchair.
Wheelchair, come. That's no way to talk to a man who's just reached 35.
You're 35? 35 mm-hmm. times what?
Wait a minute. You're snapping your wig, my boy. If you remember at my last birthday party, I had a cake with only 35 candles on it.
Yeah, but at the bottom it said continued on the next cake. But what does age matter? I saw your last picture and I thought you were great.
That's a coincidence, so did I.
Read that line again. There's a talent scout here tonight from the Wilson Ham Company.
Any stamp, he'll make you grade A, I'm sure.
Like the stag one, a pink one. You know, we ought to make a picture together again, Bing. I stopped over at your house last night to talk to you about it, but nobody was home.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, I must have rung your bell about five times.
Six times.
Oh, so it was you up in the window with the hot oil, huh? Look, Vigor, old boy, you're just jealous because I made the pale face without you.
Me jealous of Bob Hope?
Mm-hmm.
I have so much more than Ho's nose. Why should I fight it?
Tell me, Bob,
I get to laugh without even reading it. I love that. How'd you feel having Jane Russell opposite you instead of me in that picture?
How would anyone feel switching to filet mignon after a diet of hog's livers?
Hold it, swivel snout, hold it.
But really, Bing, we always have so much fun making pictures together. People seem to like them. They do well at the box office. How come we haven't worked together lately?
Oh, I don't know. Just lucky, I guess. I don't know how to break this to you, kid, but on the screen, you sort of cramp my style.
What do you mean?
Well, for my money, you don't look too good.
With your money, nobody has to look too good. Excuse me, Bing, I didn't mean to raise my voice.
That's all right.
You're sure I didn't blow your hearing aid?
I'm tuned into We the People. I'm on a two-party line. Besides, kid, I like to do a lot of singing in my pictures, and with you around, it's just...
Singing?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to say anything, but when you sang your song before, you sounded like Jessica with her net dragging. Why don't you give up?
Give up? Singing is my life, Robert.
It is, huh?
Of course, I've been lucky. There's the radio and the records and the jukeboxes, but I dare say I'd have been a singer 200 years ago.
Weren't you?
I ignore that and repeat, Bob, that 200 years ago, I still could have made a living with my pipes.
Are you kidding? I suppose composers like Mozart and Beethoven would have been writing songs for you.
Not wholly impossible. I can see myself asking Ludwig von Beethoven to knock out a little ditty for me.
Almost sounds as if we're going into a sketch.
Could be.
Start that racket and finish that symphony already.
Ach, der Lieber.
I've got to stop those jam sessions mit Dizzy von Gillespie.
Oh, Ludwig. Ludwig.
Ja, Mama.
I've got a message for you. Mo called.
Mo who?
Mozart.
Mama, have you been spiking the strudel again?
There's somebody here to see you. Herr Bingel von Krosbein.
Oh, well, send him in.
Good day. I'm Herr von Krosbein.
Who?
Herr von Krosbein.
The Krosbein, I believe, but where the hell?
Say, tell me, is that your nose or are you eating a sausage?
Yeah. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm a singer.
A broken-down schnook like you is a zinger? Ach, du Liverwurst, this has given me mine Charlie's.
I have, you know, I'm Bingel von Krosbein, the famous singer. For 3 years, I played at Schlapsy Fritz's. And I've come all the way from Unter den Linden to see you. Jawohl, auch der Liebe und unter Blitzen, you Schweinhund, you.
Lean back, Dummkopf, you're getting Limburger on the microphone.
Believe me, that's an improvement. Look, Beethoven, I got a deal for you. You're
what's
a
that?
Composer, I'm a singer.
All right, I let's try a song together.
Good,
good. You know, Krosbein, I dedicated this composition to that wonderful restaurant that used to be on Oberhauser Street.
Oh, yeah, you mean that delicatessen place where they had those king-sized pig teeth?
Yeah. Heine worked behind the bar and he had a big red nose.
Mo would make the Wiener Schnitzel und the sauerkraut with the minis in the middle.
What a wonderful place was Heine's and Mo's. They never would light out the lights cause the place would never close.
Und Schultz would play a squeeze box all of it off to leave us such a beautiful smoke.
You could blow your top in Heine's and Mo's.
Ach, we must the gay blades in those days, eh, mein Herr?
Yeah, I remember we belonged to the Wilhelmstrasse and pickled herring and necking society.
Yeah. Sometimes we got around with a pickled herring.
Yeah. Oh, you fracture me, Krosbein.
Oh, you stinker, you.
Don't care.
Has your nose always been like that, or did you have that ballpoint put on it there? Yeah. What is it?
The free lunch was gorgeous. The beer was always cold.
Und the dancing with the women. Ah, the women.
Ja, ihr wollt.
You could smell the place for 16 blocks.
And it wasn't any rose. Garlic cheese and old Limburger.
And pickles mixed with the herring together. And the meatballs tasted just like leather.
Chopped up liver and bologna. Pickled pig's feet that were bony. And salami.
Hey, Professor.
What is it?
Now you heard me sing. How do you like my voice?
Please, not while I'm eating.
Where the place is jumping, let's all go down to Heine's and
more. I want to thank Bing Crosby for being with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, we're making plans for next Tuesday's show and we'd like your advice. Would you rather have me sing Buttons and Bows, or would you rather have Jane Russell? Well, next Tuesday, I'm just kidding. That gal you'd like to see most in her Christmas stockings, my two-gun mate from the Pale Face will be here, Jane Russell. And folks, there are only 15 more shopping days before Christmas, which is still plenty of time to remember the scientists who are looking for a cure for arthritis. If you want to help, write to Arthritis, Box 1200, General Post Office, New York, New York.
Millions of people have arthritis. Millions of dollars are needed. So don't forget the address. Arthritis, Box 1200, General Post Office, New York, New York.
Thanks, and good night, everybody.
The Bob Hope Show on Tuned to Yesterday from December 7th, 1948 on NBC. You're listening to an hour of Christmas broadcasts on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for Dragnet with an episode called The Big 22 Rifle for Christmas. The radio show also playing in tandem with the television version, and this particular story was seen on the small screen 3 days before the radio program. This NBC episode from December 21st, 1952.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent. You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned to homicide detail. A small boy is reported missing from his home. His age, 9 years. Foul play is suspected. Your job, find him.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Thursday, December 22nd. It was cold in Los Angeles. We were working the night watch out of homicide. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Thad Brown, chief of detectives. My name's Friday. I was on the way into work, and it was 3:55 p.m. when I got to room 42. Homicide.
Hi, Joe.
Ben, what's doing?
Oh, pretty quiet. How's your mother?
Well, that cold's still hanging on. Bad cough. Doc says nothing serious.
My kid's got the same thing. Must be some kind of a virus going around.
Yeah.
Is that a new suit you got on?
Oh, yeah. Ma figured I needed one.
Let me see. Oh, yeah, that's a nice shade of blue. Where'd you get it?
Quincy's, down in South Fig. Look okay?
Turn around. Oh, yeah, that's a good fit.
Did you get all the reports on the Webster case yet?
Yeah, all taken care of.
Let me get it. Homicide, Friday.
This is Levinson, Unit 113J. Got something for you.
Yeah, Harry, what's doing?
Doherty and I are out here on Collis Avenue, 4656. Trying to track down a 9-year-old boy.
What's the story?
The kid's missing, suspicion of foul play.
How long has he been gone?
About 2 hours. Looks like a job for homicide.
How do you figure?
The kid was last seen playing in the backyard of his home.
Yeah?
We checked over the yard.
Find anything?
Bloodstains, lots of them. They look new.
Ben and I left a message for Chief of Detectives Thad Brown. Then we went over to the crime lab, picked up Lieutenant Lee Jones, and drove out the Arroyo Seco freeway to Collis Avenue. It was an average neighborhood. Number 4656 was a one-story green stucco residence situated on the corner of Collis Avenue and Harrison Drive. Beyond the backyard was a tract of undeveloped land covered with scrub oak. Harry Levinson from Highland Park Juvenile was waiting for us in front of the house.
Back this way, fellas.
I'm coming, Lee.
Wait till I get my bag.
Okay. Who notified you that the boy was missing, Harry?
The mother. Said she went out to do some Christmas shopping about 11 this morning, left the boy home. She came back about 2 this afternoon, he was gone.
What's the name?
Johnstone. Kid's name is Stanley, 9 years old.
Mm-hmm. Was this gate open like this when you got here?
Oh, yeah, I haven't touched a thing. Here are the stains over here, Lieutenant Jones, along the edge of the walk, see?
Yeah, let me see. Mm.
Quite a few stains, huh?
Looks like it might be blood. I'll try some benzidine on these spots here. Now, there we are. See what happens?
Where's the kid's mother now, Harry?
In the house. Doherty's talking to her.
Did you talk to any of the neighbors?
People next door. One's on this side. They couldn't tell us anything.
There it is, fellas.
Yelly?
These spots I covered with benzidine. They're turning blue. Bloodstains, all right. Can't say definitely whether it's human or animal blood.
Mm-hmm. You have to go back to the lab to run it through?
Yeah, biological precipitant test. Hand me one of those glass vials from my bag, will you?
Yeah. Okay, here you are.
Thanks. Scrape some of these flakes off for a test. There we are.
How soon can you tap the blood force, Link?
Precipitant tests won't run more than 20 minutes. It'll take 3 or 4 hours to run a blood grouping, though. That's it. Anything else you want to check?
Levinson, anything else?
Oh, right here, my handkerchief. Empty shell. That marker over there by the rose bush, that's where I found it.
From a .22, huh?
Yeah. Might tie in, might not.
Mark it and dump it in this envelope, will you?
Oh, yeah. Shell. There you go.
Did you get out a missing broadcast in the boy, Harry?
Darty did about 30 minutes ago. Oh, here's a description here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mother know about the bloodstain?
No, we didn't tell her. She's worried enough already.
And she has no idea what might have happened to her boy?
No more than we do. She checked all her friends, relatives. We're covering the neighborhood. No trace so far.
Not much to go on.
Bloodstains, empty cartridge.
Could mean 100 things.
Mm. Any ideas, Franny?
Yeah, just one, and I don't like it. p.m., Thursday, December 22nd. The neighborhood search for 9-year-old Stanley Johnstone continued. Lee Jones went back to the crime lab to start the precipitant test and the blood grouping. Levinson and his partner Doherty from Highland Juvenile stood by. We called Chief of Detectives Thad Brown, and he ordered up a special detail to aid in the search for the missing boy. Ben and I questioned the boy's mother, Mrs. Ruth Johnstone, a woman in her early 40s. She seemed fairly calm under the circumstances.
Mrs. Johnstone, is your boy Stan in the habit of wandering off without telling you where he's going?
No, he's not in the habit of wandering off, but he has done it before.
When was the last time, Miss Johnstone?
You don't have any children, do you, Sergeant Friday?
No, I'm not married.
Well, there comes that time in every young boy's life when he feels that it's time to leave home, to go out on his own. Usually happens somewhere around 8 to 10.
I think I know what you mean. I've got a boy.
Well, then you know how it is. My husband and I scolded Stanley one day after school. He was quite put out about it. He thought George and I were unfair. Packed a few of his things and left.
How long was he gone?
Oh, no time at all. About 2 hours. I was worried about him, but my husband said to leave him alone. Said every boy had to go through that stage.
Well, then you think he's run away from home again this time?
Yes, I think so. He's been gone about 4 hours now, and I have a funny feeling about it.
Did you and his father have some misunderstanding with the boy recently?
Well, that's just it. We haven't. I don't mind telling you now that we're talking about it. I am getting worried.
Any place around that he might like to visit? Hobby shop, playground, where he might be?
Yeah, there's Jensen's model shop and little Shanna Burroughs, but I've already called them, and he hasn't been seen all day. I called all his friends. They have no idea where he is either.
We'd like a list of all his friends and the places that he was known to frequent.
Oh, yeah, all right. I'll give them to you. Where do you suppose he is?
Where's your husband now, Miss Johnstone?
Oh, he's at work. George works for the city. He's a fireman.
What house is he stationed at?
Engine Company 12. He's working the A platoon. He'll be home tomorrow morning. I haven't told him that Stanley's gone.
Well, is there any chance that the boy might be down at the firehouse with his father?
No. No, he seldom goes down there anymore. No, I don't think he's there. I'm awfully worried. May I call my husband?
Certainly. Go right ahead.
I know George will be worried. Stanley's been gone too long. Hello? May I speak with George Johnstone? This is Mrs. Johnstone. Thank you. I hate to call George at his work.
Yes, ma'am. Does your husband own a gun?
Yes, he does.
What caliber? Do you know?
Well, it's a .45 automatic. He got it. George? This is Ruth. George, is Stanley down there with you by any chance? Oh. No, I can't find him anywhere. He hasn't been here when I came home from my shopping. There are two policemen here. No, I said there are two policemen here. Oh, no, dear. I'll call you if we don't find him soon. All right, dear. Yes, you too. Goodbye. I didn't think he'd be with George.
That .45, is that the only gun in the household?
Well, yes. Why are you asking about guns? Has anything happened that you're not telling me about?
No, ma'am. Just routine checking. We'll have to take a look at that .45 off, if you don't mind.
Maybe I should tell you. We do have another gun in the house, but it's all wrapped up. George bought it for Stanley's Christmas present.
May we see it, please?
Well, yes. Will you have to unwrap it?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
I think I can reach it. We had to hide it. Now, let me see. Oh, here's the paper it was wrapped in. Stanley must have found it. It's gone. See, here's the gift card and the box the gun came in, the rifle.
Can I look at that box, ma'am? Thank you.
How about it, Joe?
.22 caliber. Thursday, December 22nd, 5:15 p.m. It was getting dark. The search for the missing boy continued. We checked the list of Stanley Johnstone's friends. None of them or their parents had any idea of his whereabouts. We talked with Levinson again. He had been in touch with the detail combing the neighborhood. They had found nothing. We went down to Collis Avenue and 10th Street, service station on the corner.
One nickel, Joe?
No, I got one. You watch for that, huh?
Yeah.
City Hall.
2667, please.
2667.
Crime Lab, Jones.
Hi, Lee. Joe Friday.
Yeah, Joe. Any sign of the Johnson kid?
No, not yet. How are you coming?
Finished the precipitant test. It's human blood.
Yeah?
Working in the blood group now. Do you know what type the Johnson boy has?
Well, we didn't want to upset his mother. I thought we'd wait till the last thing. We're still in the neighborhood.
I check with the family physician. That way you won't disturb
him. Yeah, we figured on that. Oh, just a minute, Lee.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ben.
Boss just pulled up.
Okay. Thad Brown's out here now. I'll check you later, Lee, huh?
Yeah, right, Joe.
All right, goodbye.
Gentlemen, how's it going?
Just checked with Lee Jones.
Yeah, I know. It's human blood. What do you think?
We talked with the boy's mother, Miss Johnston. Found a gun missing.
Yeah.
Caliber's the same as the empty casing that Levinson found. .22.
You said the gun was missing.
Yeah, the Johnstones were going to give it to the boy as a Christmas present. They had it hidden, but it's gone now.
Any idea who took it?
Well, they left the Christmas wrapping behind. I think it was the kid.
.22 rifle, huh? 9-year-old boy. When are they going to learn? First, it's carbide cannons on the 4th of July. The city issued ordinance after ordinance, but a few thousand kids around the country had to lose their eyes, fingers, hands before the parents gives us their full cooperation to outlaw them.
I know what you mean.
Sure you do. You and every other cop in the country became the heavies trying to clamp down on them. It's always the same story. This time it's guns for Christmas.
I know what you're thinking, but we're not sure yet.
Listen, Friday, there's a city ordinance against giving a gun to a kid. You know that.
Yes, I know that.
There's a missing boy and a missing gun. There's blood on the ground and an empty shell. That's enough for me.
I'm going to stay with it. Something's got to break.
Yeah. I hope it's not the hearts of that kid's parents.
Oh, hi, Chief. I've been looking for you, Friday.
What do you got, Harry?
Found a gun. New .22 rifle. Strong smell of cordite. I'd say it's been recently fired.
Where'd you find it, Levinson?
Back up there in that scrub oak. Up behind the Johnston house. Mrs. Johnstone identified it. Buckley took it down the crime lab.
Thanks, Harry. Is Miss Johnston okay?
Pretty sick now. Killaby came up with something else.
What's that?
There's another one missing. An 8-year-old boy.
6:30 p.m. We talked with Officer Killaby about the other missing boy. He told us that his name was Stephen Moorheim, 8 years old. His family had just moved into the neighborhood, and it seemed that no one besides the Moorheim family knew that the boys played together. Mrs. Moorheim told us that Stephen told her that he was going out to play and that he'd be home by 6 o'clock for dinner. She told us that he was an unusually prompt boy and almost never overstayed his playtime. We got a description of the Moorheim boy and put out a missing broadcast. We called the Johnstones' family doctor. He told us that Stanley's blood was type O. At 7 p.m., we talked again with Mrs. John Moorheim.
Are you sure Mrs. Johnstone doesn't know where the boys are?
She has no idea, Ms. Moorheim.
It's terrible. It's just awful. I feel there's more to this thing. Something you're not telling me.
Well, there's no use to upset you until we know a few things for sure.
Then you are holding back something.
Now, please try not to worry, Ms. Moorheim. There are certain questions we'll have to ask, routine questions in any kind of investigation.
Is there anything else you want to know?
Yes, ma'am. What is your boy's blood type?
That's a funny question. Do you think anything's happened to him? Have you found him and you're not telling me?
No, ma'am, we haven't found him. We don't think anything's happened to him.
His blood type?
Yes, ma'am.
I think I have it written down in Stevie's baby book. Yes, here it is. Hi,
Paul. Thank you. Wonder if I might use your phone, please?
Yes, of course. It's in the hall.
Be right back then.
Yeah, okay.
City Hall.
2667, please.
2667.
Crime Lab, Pinker.
Hello, Ray. This is Friday. Lee there?
Just a minute, Joe.
Take two, Lee.
Jones speaking.
Checking back, Lee.
Did you get the blood types on the two missing boys?
Yeah, both boys type O.
So were the stains, Joe. Type O.
Mm-hmm.
are listening to Dragnet, for the solution to an actual case from official police files.
...8 p.m., Thursday, December 22nd. Still no sign of either of the missing boys. Chief of Detectives Thad Brown went back to headquarters to direct the search from there. He dispatched another detail of 50 men to aid in the hunt for the missing youngsters. 8:30 p.m. It was getting colder. The citrus growers were warned to expect a freeze. We went up the block to see Mrs. Johnstone. Her husband had quit work early and returned home. We talked with him. He could tell us nothing more than we already knew. We still had not informed either of the families about the bloodstains and the empty cartridge casing which had been discovered in the backyard of the Johnstone home. It was more than possible that they had a right to know about our findings, but Ben and I felt that there was no cause to add to the distress of the two families at this time. If the two missing boys were found alive and well, then the bloodstains and the cartridge case would be of no concern to the relieved parents. At 8:40 p.m., Ben and I left the Johnstone house and went to the home of Mr. and Mrs. John Morheim.
Ms. Morheim, you said your husband worked at a market?
Yes. He telephoned about 15 minutes ago and said he was closing up right away. He'll be here any minute. I do wish Stevie would call or come home. It's so cold out tonight. All he had on was a thin cotton jacket.
Please try not to worry. We're doing everything we can. It's going to be all right.
Stevie's father's such a sensitive man. He and the boy are so close. I know he's terribly upset.
No, you're sure there's no place you might have forgotten? Some place where the boy might be?
No, no place. No. Anything happened to the boy, it'll just kill you.
No, no.
You sit still. I'll get it, Miss Morton.
Joe?
Hi, Harry.
The Johnstone kid. He's been found.
Oh, he's home, Sergeant. He's come home. Thank God he's all right.
Where's he been? Did he tell you?
No, he didn't. His clothes were all dirty and he's acting strange. I've never seen him like this.
How do you mean, Miss Johnson?
Well, he just came in the front door and said, "Hello, Mom," and then he sat down in a chair and stared at the floor. He won't talk to his father or me.
Do you mind if I talk to him?
No, go ahead. I asked him about the little Morheim boy and he wouldn't tell me a thing.
Where is he now?
In the living room.
Looks all right.
Yes. Son. Son, this is a police officer. He wants to talk to you. Now, don't be afraid, dear. He only wants to ask you some questions. Son. You see, Sergeant?
Stanley, come on, look at me, son. Get your head up, youngster. Come on, now that's better. I had your mother pretty worried, you know that? You want to tell us where you've been?
I wish you'd try to get him to eat a little something.
Do you hear that, son? Want something to eat? Stanley, there's another little boy up the street who hasn't come home. Do you know where he is? His father and mother are worried about him, too, just like your folks were. You've got to help us find him, son.
I killed him. I killed Steve with the .22. We were only playing. But I killed him.
How do you know you killed him? Maybe he's only hurt. Now, isn't that it?
No, he's dead. I know he's dead. The gun went off. We forgot we put bullets in there.
Where is he, Stanley?
I hid him. I was scared. I didn't want anybody to find him.
Where did you hide him, son?
In a cave up on the hill. I didn't mean it. It was my pal.
You want to show us where, son?
Yes, I'll show you. Please, don't send me to jail.
9:15 p.m., Thursday, December 22nd. 9-year-old Stanley Johnstone led the way up the hill behind the backyard of his home. He showed us the wagon he moved the body in. His father came along with us. About 50 feet from the crest of the hill, the boy pointed to a thicket of scrub oak. There we found a small cave holding the body of Stephen Morheim. There was a single bullet wound in his chest just below his heart. He was dead. We covered the body.
Stanley. Stanley, how did it happen?
I knew my folks were going to give me the gun for Christmas. I knew where it was, and I got it. There was a box of bullets with it.
Were you pointing the gun at Stephen?
No, sir. No, sir, I wasn't. It was Steve's turn to play with it. I was chasing him. He tripped over the stump there in our backyard and fell. The gun hit him in the stomach, and it went off.
Why do you think you killed him if you're telling us the truth?
I'm telling the truth, honest. That's the truth.
All right, I believe you, son, but why do you think you killed him?
It was my gun. Steve would still be alive if I didn't go and get it. I should have waited till Christmas. It's all my fault.
Where have you been all this time?
In the cave with Steve.
What were you doing in there, son?
I was praying. I was praying for God to make him alive again.
After a thorough investigation, Ben and I were convinced that the shooting of Stephen Moorheim was accidental. Lieutenant Lee Jones' findings substantiated the Johnstone boy's story even to the smallest detail. We put in a call to the coroner's office and acquainted him with the facts. He designated a local mortuary to handle the body pending autopsy and granted us permission to remove the body to the Moorheim home. Mrs. Moorheim collapsed. The family doctor was called. Ben and I sat in the living room to wait for John Moorheim, the dead boy's father.
Edith! Edith!
Mr. Moorheim?
Yes. You the police?
Yes, sir.
Where's Edith? Where's my wife? Has my boy come home? Have you found him?
Yes, sir.
Where is he? Steve! Stevie! Where's Steve? He's hurt, isn't he?
Yes, sir.
Oh, where is he? I want to see him.
He's hurt bad, Mr. Moorheim.
Oh, where is he? I want to see him.
He's in his room.
How bad?
Pretty bad.
He's dead. All right, if I go in.
If you want to.
Will you go with me?
Sure. Don't make it any harder on yourself, Mr. Moorheim.
I want to see my boy. Stevie.
Mr. Moorheim.
Stevie, Stevie, Stevie. Listen to me, son. We've got you a lot of nice things for Christmas. Everything you wanted. I got you those 3 new cars for the train. The one with the searchlight is... really works. Son, you got that new switch you wanted to, and a lot more track. Oh, dear. Now you can have a big payout. You know that new baseball bat you saw? Well, I got it for you. That cowboy outfit you wanted, I got that too.
Mr. Moorheim. Come on, Joe.
What happened?
It was an accident. He was playing with Johnstone boy up the street. Playing with a gun. He went off.
What was the other boy's name?
Stanley Johnstone. It was an accident.
Mr. Moorheim, where are you going?
I want to see that boy.
We had no idea what the dead boy's father had in mind. We didn't feel that we should try to restrain him. We went along with him up the street to the Johnstone home.
I'm Stevie's father. Where's your boy?
I'm sorry.
Where's your boy?
He's right here. Won't you come in?
It's all right, Mrs. Johnstone.
You the boy that was with Stevie?
Yes, sir.
What's your name?
Stanley.
Stanley. I know it wasn't your fault, Stanley. I wonder if you'd do something for me.
Yes, sir.
I've got a lot of nice presents for Stevie. I know he'd want you to have them. I want to give them to you. Christmas Eve.
Mom?
I think that would be a fine idea, son.
Come on, Ben. What does it all prove, Joe? You don't give a kid a gun for Christmas.
The story you have just heard was true. Only the names were changed to protect the innocent.
On December 24th, 1948, a coroner's inquest was held in the county morgue, city and county of Los Angeles, state of California. In a moment, the results of that inquest. At the coroner's inquest, it was officially recorded that Stephen Morheim's death was the result of an accident. Stanley Johnstone, age 9, was absolved of any legal responsibility for his friend's death.
Dragnet, on Tuned to Yesterday from December 21st, 1952 on NBC. Bringing to a close this hour of Christmas broadcasts on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVernier. Happy holidays.